Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. An absolute treat to have a wonderful actor. And we're going to talk about a new movie coming out that I know a lot of people are going to be so excited about. But you know him primarily as a child actor. And on Little House on the Prairie, he was John Jr. Was Mr. Edwards' adopted son, I think the oldest son there, and he became the love interest of Mary Ingalls, and he was terrific in that. And you've seen him on so many episodic shows. For example, Marcus Welby, Family Affair. I think I saw him on a Family Affair. Johnny Whitaker and Brian Keith. But I remember him, and I'll tell you, you talk about good acting chops, great acting chops, in The Night Gallery. And if I remember correctly, it was Orson Welles had some kind of voiceover work in it. And he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but everyone remembers him as Grasshopper, Young Kane in Kung Fu. And what a terrific talent he was and still is. And we're going to find out much more about him. Rodimus Perah is our very special guest. Rodimus, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's truly an honor.
Yeah, well, same. Your honor is mine. And The Night Gallery, do I have that right? Was Orson Welles? I haven't seen it in years, but you played a teen or a kid, and you were kind of just, it was a disturbing role. But was Orson Welles involved with your Night Gallery?
He was, and also in a very interesting way, David Carradine was too. Can I tell you the story?
Please. Oh, I'd love it.
Okay, so starting with your first question, Orson Welles was originally sought to be the narrator for that short story. It's a Conrad Aiken Pulitzer Prize-winning short story that was once a black and white film. You can actually find it still, the original version of it, on YouTube. And then Gene Kearney, the director and producer of this episode with Universal, working for Night Gallery, and Rod Serling, wanted to do this remake of it, basically. And he saw it, he heard it in his mind's eye with Orson Welles' narration. So they sent the script to Welles' office with a nice cover letter, you know, please, you know, name your price, Mr. Welles, where you want to record this, and we'll get it done. And they didn't hear back. So they went into production, and they filmed my parts in it. And yes, and you were saying, this, it's ambiguous. It is. It's an ambiguous story. You don't know whether this boy is autistic or going insane or possessed or something's going on with him. And then there's this very lilting narration going on with, of course, the great voice of Orson Welles. So they sent the script out to him, and they didn't hear back. And they're like, okay. So they filmed the episode with me and everything. They're putting it together. Still no Orson. What's going on? What's going on? So they're getting now very close to air date. And like 3 days before they were supposed to air the show, this envelope, manila envelope, arrives on the desk of Mr. Kearney, the director, and with nothing in it but a reel of quarter-inch magnetic tape, and the entire narration was on it.
They
rushed it over to the editing suite, and they, you know, got it done, and they put it in. And it turns out that it was one of Orson Welles' favorite short stories. So he just loved doing it and did it and just, you know, didn't answer until he could do it with the actual product. So that's the story behind that. I unfortunately never got to meet him, which is sad.
Oh.
But the interesting Carradine tie-in is, as you may recall, those shows were done with episodes of two paintings were shown in an hour-long format. And one painting was Silent Snow, Secret Snow, and the other painting that Rod Serling introduced was something called The Phantom Farmhouse. And The Phantom Farmhouse starred David McCallum, who is from Man from U.N.C.L.E., mm-hmm. and David Carradine playing a mystic, kind of a mysterious, mystical character who lives in a treehouse and plays a flute, right?
Wow, yeah.
So I think that when, and this was before Kung Fu, so I think that when David was, you know, trying out for the role and his agents were submitting him, they said, here, take a look at this piece of footage that he recently did. I think that this is a shoe-in for Kwai Chang Kane. And they played, you know, his part. And, of course, on the same reel was probably my episode. And they said, well, let's watch this thing with Orson Welles just for fun. We have 20 minutes, don't we? Gene, yeah, okay, let's do it. So they watched it, And, well, hey, wow, this kid, okay, he's got some, like you said, quoting you, acting chops, and maybe, I mean, we should bring him in. Maybe we've got a two-for-one thing going on here. And I think, I haven't verified this, but I have a feeling that that's kind of how it went down.
Wow.
So we were already in the same TV show before we were in the same TV show.
Just wow. I mean, what a, you know, you talk about kismet there. And David Carradine, what a great actor he was. Rodimus Parah is the voice that you're hearing. If you're just joining us or if you're just turning on your radios, Rodimus is known for so many roles, but certainly he will never be forgotten as Grasshopper on Kung Fu Young Kane with the late, great David Carradine as his mentor there. And by the way, in real life, I've heard and I've read over the years, and maybe I'm misremembering, but David Carradine referred to you as a son. I mean, sincerely referred to you as a son. Now, am I misremembering that, or was there a good relationship there, a close relationship there?
I'll be very honest with you and tell you that I had not ever heard that. This would be the first I'd ever heard that he referred to me in that way. That would be nice to think that. Although, like I said, you're the first person to tell me that. So maybe you've heard things that I didn't hear.
Would that surprise you?
Slightly, only because, we definitely had a friendship. We were playing the same character. You know, he was never my direct mentor in the show, and nor was he really in real life. But to be honest, also, I was very intrigued by him as a kid. I was 11, 12, 13 years old when we were working on the show, 14. And, because he was playing me as an older version of me.
Yeah.
And because my mom already knew him from something that happened before, years before, with the two of them, which was interesting, which I can tell you about sometime. And she didn't like him. It made him even more intriguing to me, you know. So we were on the set at the same time a few times, and I would try to have lunch with him if my mom wasn't looking, and he was a very interesting person, you know, a very conflicted person. I didn't really understand what that conflict was at the time, but if you can imagine, he was very much trying to live a countercultural lifestyle in the early 70s. While having signed a contract with a multinational corporation, you know, so there was a bit of a conflict there in him, and so he was a very conflicted person. He lived kind of outside of the norms of the day and sort of pushed on the envelope of he kind of lived on the edge, I guess I'll say, and unfortunately he also his demise came
on
from
the edge,
living
on
the edge as well. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to play, I can't play it unfortunately now, but I think I have what where he says it, and maybe it might be off air that I show it to you, but and you could respond to that. I thought it was interesting because I had no idea what your relationship was with him. It's interesting. You said your mother didn't like him. She didn't like David Carradine.
Here's the backstory on that.
Yeah.
In 1963, David and my mother were both actors in New York City working on the Broadway and off-Broadway stages. And at that time, it was in the last days of what was called the studio system in L.A., in Hollywood, where they would send scouts out to New York to find good actors and bring them to L.A. and test them to see if they could become contract players, which was what was called the contract player system, where they would be part of a stable of actors that the different studios would keep under contract. So my mother was fortunate enough and talented enough to be plucked that way, and on the same airplane, staying at the same motel and doing the same tests with her on that trip was David Carradine. So they had some interaction. I don't know the details, honestly. When I was cast as Grasshopper, finally, she said, "Oh, so who is playing the older Kane?" And they said, "David Carradine." And she went, "Oh, David Carradine." And they went, "Oh, do you know David?" And she said, "I know where he lives." And they went, "Okay, I guess we won't touch that one with a 10-foot pole." Okay. So yeah, I don't know what happened between them, but clearly she didn't dig him very much. So, but that made it more interesting to me. You know, hey, who's this guy that my mom doesn't like? Okay, I got to check him out, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, listen, I think I have the clip. I'm going to try this. If it doesn't work, everyone, forgive me. Audience, please forgive me. But I'm going to try this. It's a little YouTube thing, and I'm being told. Let me see. David Carradine talks about Rodimus Parah. And I'm going to see if this comes across. And if we don't hear it, everyone forgive me, and I'll shut it off right away. It's a short clip. Can you hear that?
It's often said that to be effective...
I don't hear anything right now, no.
Oh.
...brightness and great force.
Hold on.
But what is to be gained from such a course?
I got it in my headphones here.
Okay. I love that kid so much. Rodimus.
Is a righteous action.
He was, in a way, my son.
Yeah. He said, I love that kid so much. Rodimus, in a way, he was like my son. That was his quote.
Wow.
And in it, I'm going to send it to you. Yeah, it's, boy, that's fascinating, right? That you would be surprised that David Carradine would say that. And who knows? You know, he was a flaky guy. I don't know. Is that the right word? He's mercurial? What's the right word?
Mercurial would be putting it kindly.
Okay, yeah. Crazy, right? I mean, a lot of people saw him as being, you know, a little nutty. And whatever, but he was a tortured guy. He was a great actor, though, is what he was.
I think tortured would be closest. I mean, look, his original first name was John. Ah. He was living in the shadow of his great actor father, John Carradine.
Yeah.
He changed his name to David to sort of distinguish himself from his dad. Those were big shoes to fill, and his dad cast a long shadow. Both literally and figuratively, in the horror movies that he did and stuff. Look, David was, like I said, you know, that whole point about him being, you know, wanting to live a countercultural lifestyle while still, you know, he loved the fame and he also rejected it at the same time. He was, I don't want to use the word confused because that's too oversimplified. He was conflicted. He was a conflicted man. And I think maybe toward the end of his life, when I didn't know him in the last few years of his life, I think he resolved some of that stuff, but... most of the time he was kind of, like I said, he was just pushing on the edge. He was constantly challenging authority in his own mind, you know? Mm.
Rodimus Parah is the voice that you're hearing, just a wonderful actor, and a new film coming out, Kung Fu Reboot. I mean, we got to figure out how to properly, respectfully lay this out, because there are so many people that are going to be so excited about this. I'm one of them, and I know the listeners out there are, and it is such a huge concentration now on pop culture that, you know, while you were making this, while you and David Carradine and others were making this great show, I'm sure you had no idea what the impact would be on pop culture. But again, Rodimus Parah is our very special guest. Frank McKay here with Rodimus. Respond to that. Let's talk a little bit about the film. Can you explain to me? I know very little about what's happening and what's about to happen. Can you give us a rundown?
Yeah, thanks for letting me fill you in. So there's two things happening simultaneously. There's a reboot of the TV show that's being done by the CW, Greg Berlanti Productions, and in that they've got the premise. It's in present day. The premise is that a Chinese-American, she's Chinese or family, they're American, they live in San Francisco, they go to China for a visit, the oldest daughter is enamored with the Chinese culture, she decides to stay, and her family goes back to San Francisco to their business in Chinatown, and she stays in China and meets a teacher, a lady, who teaches Shaolin Kung Fu, and she stays there for 3 years and then comes back to San Francisco, where her family is being threatened by some Chinese gang activity, and so she seeks revenge on the fact that her family is being threatened and that her teacher was killed by the head of this particular gang. That's the premise of the pilot. I don't know anything beyond that as far as what the series will flesh out, but I will say this about the premise. David Carradine put it best, I think, at one point in an interview where he said that Kung Fu, the original show, was an anti-revenge series. And I think that DNA that the character, you know, what happened with the original Qui-Chang Kane in the original series, how he tried to always find the most good in every situation, and even when he had to get himself into, even when he got himself in a situation where he had to fight, he always tried to do the least amount of harm in the situation that he could. This new show, I have a hard time finding the original DNA in it. I hope they find it. I didn't see it in the script, so I'm neither rejecting it nor sanctioning it. I'm just saying I hope they hire some good writers to try to bring in some of the philosophy, because it just, there wasn't enough of it there in the integrity of the characters and in the premise. I just, you know, so that's the TV show. Now, the other part of your question was there's also a movie. Now, the movie is being done in a completely different group of people. I don't know yet whether they're setting it as a period piece, whether they're going to set it back in the Old West, or if they're going to try to contemporize it as well. But it being a movie and being done by a different group of people, my hope is that they will have a different mindset about it, and that it will, because I think, you know, listen, let's go back to the original thing. People watch that show religiously. This is the word I've heard over the decades. Wow, we used to watch that show religiously. That's such a fascinating word to choose when describing watching a TV show. There was something in it for people. We had just come out of the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, and the 70s was a period of people trying to piece together how to make this mind-blowing information we had just gotten as a culture, how to make it practical. Well, here enter Qui-Chang Kane, who is a Shaolin priest who tries to practice what he has been taught. And we got to see him put into practical situations those kernels of philosophy that my scenes and the flashbacks were the, you know, contained those kernels. And that formula really worked. It really appealed to the modern psyche, who was looking for meaning and looking for a way to function in a positive way. So if a show contains that in it, I think it'll be a huge success. If it doesn't have that in it, I don't see why people will want to watch it.
Yeah, well, listen, good point and very honest. Radames Perah is here and thrilled to have him. And some of his other credits, the Bill Cosby Show, the original Bill Cosby Show.
right.
Lassie. Marcus Welby, you know, wow, I mean, I'm just, Red Dawn, we forgot about Red Dawn, too. Little House on the Prairie, as we mentioned, Night Gallery, as we mentioned. I mean, what a resume you put together as a young guy. And I think if people watched the Night Gallery episode, they would understand why you got so much work. It looked like such a challenging role, but it stood out, and it's so memorable to me. I'm a big Rod Serling fan. But you, for a young guy, I think you really got a handle on a you know, you used the word ambiguous. I didn't, but on an ambiguous character. And boy, was that a challenge as an actor to do what you did in that episode? And again, I didn't realize Orson Welles wasn't there, but I have to believe he would have loved what you did in it.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I would love to think that's true. Yeah, thank you. Look, I started my career playing Anthony Quinn's dying son in a feature film called A Dream of Kings, and I think that because Hollywood is a place that typecasts very quickly, very easily, you get pigeonholed as one thing. Fortunately, I guess on some level, I was cast, you know, as this dying kid, and therefore my career, I ended up playing the sensitive, injured, diseased, ambiguously autistic characters, which made me a character actor, a young character actor. And so my mom was an actress, and I think she helped me as best as she could. I think I enjoyed the make-believe and the challenge of pleasing the adults and, you know, who I was working with. And it was fun. I have to say I enjoyed it. And also, to be also honest with you, or just reveal, I mean, something about my personal life, my mom was into Eastern philosophy long before I got cast in Kung Fu. So I think my mind was capable of kind of looking at things outside of the box, and even things that, like you mentioned several times now, the Night Gallery, it allowed me to imagine other realities, perhaps, other ways of thinking about things. I'm just analyzing this in retrospect. At the time, it was very subjective. I was just trying to be this kid who is separating from reality and going into this little fantasy world, which is really what the story is about. He's this, we don't know why or what's really going on with him, but clearly this boy wants to be in this other reality, not in the one that he's, you know, actually living in. So I was able to understand that concept and do my best with very good direction. I mean, Gene Kearney, very good director. Interesting thing happened on the set of that. The cinematographer, and I'm not
Wait,
sure...
Let me ask you to just keep your thought for 1 second. Let me just remind folks, Rodimus Parah is the voice that you're hearing. And if you stepped away, Frank McKay here, reminding everyone who may have stepped away, welcome back, first of all, and second of all, you're listening to Breaking It Down. And Rodimus Parah is our very special guest, and he is just a wonderful actor, and you know his work from Kung Fu. You'll never forget him as Grasshopper, Young Kane from Kung Fu, and certainly Little House on the Prairie. John Jr., the adopted son of Mr. Edwards, and Mary Ingalls' love interest, and so many other shows. We mentioned Night Gallery before the break, and the Bill Cosby Show, Family Affair, Lassie, just all types of work. And worked with Anthony Quinn as his dying son in his first role ever. Just Rodimus Parah, a treat to have him. Welcome back to you, Rodimus. And right before our break, you started telling us something, and I cut you off. Do you remember where you were?
Yeah, I think I was talking about, well, just a little aside. I've never told this part of the story on Night Gallery, since you're interested in that so much.
Please,
I thought it would be. Yeah, so I don't know. Again, I don't know if this was arranged by the director or whether the cinematographer took it upon himself to do this. I don't know, you know, because sometimes they have to sort of do things to actors to make them do what they want. So at one point while we were filming Night Gallery, the cinematographer came up to me and said, "You are the worst child actor that's ever worked on this, you know, that I've ever worked with." And I was like, I was shocked. And I wonder maybe if perhaps that wasn't done intentionally to make me kick myself into a higher gear, to sort of up my own game, to be challenged by someone. It was very hurtful. I was devastated
terrible.
When this guy
wow.
said that.
What a terrible
but,
thing.
But perhaps it made me try harder, and maybe that's what they wanted, and I don't know. I don't know why that happened, but you know, obviously, in retrospect, and over time, people like you who love that show thought I did a good job. So maybe that was one of the reasons why it was so good. I don't know.
Listen, the role you were playing, it was a disturbed kid, right? I mean, forget it. You were dynamite in that. I don't know why they would say something like that. Did you get to meet Rod Serling?
You know, sadly, no. I wish I could say I did. Oh, yeah, Rod and I went to lunch, but that didn't happen, unfortunately.
Can you imagine you had two geniuses like Orson Welles and Rod Serling on that particular show, instrumental in your episode, and you didn't get to meet either one of them? I mean, disappointing. But still, the credits are there.
Well, exactly. And so, yeah, it was a synergistic effort, for sure. So I'm proud to have been a part of it. Thank you so much for spending so much, focusing so much attention on that. It's certainly one of my favorite feathers in my cap, so thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, no question about it. And if you looked at some of your work back-to-back, including that of Young Kane in Kung Fu, and you looked at it back-to-back with some of your other work, you would say, boy, this guy's got chops. You know, this guy's got acting chops. And you really do. By the way, if I'm remembering correctly, the movie that you were that you started out in with, and I'm just going by memory, so I'm taking a chance here. Anthony Quinn, the woman who played your mother, Irene, is it Irene Pappas? She was also in Zorba the Greek, right? Was
that? Yes. She was a very popular European actress, Greek actress. Yes, wonderful person and incredible performer. Yes, so these are the two people who played my parents. So, I was very lucky to have the opportunity for my first time out to play the child of these two great actors. And they definitely taught me, you know, what good acting was. And I was only 7.5 years old when I filmed it, so or 8 years old. So yeah, it was a great experience. I'm very proud of it. Yeah, Irene Pappas, great actress. She's well known in Europe, not so well known in the States. But yes, she was in Zorba. And she worked with Anthony Quinn, yes, then. And then they reprised their relationship again in A Dream of Kings.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting dynamic. But what I'm amazed at, if you do the 6 degrees of Rodimus Perah, it would be pretty impressive, you know. And I don't know if it would match Kevin Bacon, but come pretty damn close. Think about it. You know, all of the different folks that you worked with or who worked on the same set as you or worked on the same episodes or the same show as you. You know, for example, Family Affair. And, you know, one of the conversations people have about child stars is a tragic one. And, the modern day Family Affair, I guess, was different strokes where, you know, all of the child stars had terrible experiences afterwards, you know. But again, sometimes you paint the whole group with this terrible brush. And when it comes down to it, you know, a lot of the child stars just had wonderful careers afterwards and wonderful lives afterwards. And, you know, people don't like to talk about the Jodie Fosters or the Ron Howards, you know, who went on to have these great careers. But Family Affair, there was, you know, the young girl on there who played Buffy obviously had a tragic end at a very young age. And Kathy Garver still around. Garvey, right, is still
Garver,
around.
Garver, Kathy Garver.
Garver,
yep.
And I've had her on the show several times, and she's wonderful. And John Whitaker also, and he's had his ups and downs, but he's lived to tell about it, and you know, and he's done a wonderful job in so many different ways, and he's been on the show several times. What was your impression of that set, of the Family Affair set? Did you play with the younger kids there? Did you get along with them, or was it not enough time to get to know them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I would probably have to say there probably wasn't enough time to get to know them. You know, they were working a series schedule, and I was a guest star on one episode. John and Whitaker and I are friends to this day. We still are in close touch. We see each other. Yeah. I have to sort of come back to something you said just as part of your introduction to this question and address something there. You know, you said, child stars who go on to have great careers as adults. You really can count on one hand the number who have actually done that. There's really not that many of them, to be honest with you. Most child actors, and I think you've probably heard this from Kathy and John in the past, John Whitaker, is that 99% of the kids that you see on TV today will not have adult careers. And there's two reasons for that. One, there's a burnout factor. Some of the people who do work in the industry as kids realize that they don't want to do it as adults, so they get out of it. The other one is the children who grow up and they want to have adult acting careers, they're very interested in doing that, like myself. We discovered that there was an invisible to us in the mirror, but very visible to others, expiration date tattooed on our foreheads. And what it is, and what that's about is there's a sort of unspoken stigma around child actors where, and because of that thing I mentioned earlier, typecasting, you know, when you're cast as one thing, that's who you are to the industry. If you play a villain, you're pretty much going to be playing villains the rest of your life. But when you're a kid, what happens beyond your control is you grow up. Yeah. You grow up, and all of a sudden, you're not a kid anymore, and you go for these adult roles, and they look at your resume. If you're not wise enough to exclude all your child acting credits from your resume, and it's there, they go, oh, you were a grasshopper, oh, that's right, oh, I love that show. And they look back up at you, and you're 22, 23 years old, and like, so why are you here? They don't say this, but it's like, that's right, in their eye. Yeah. And I go, I'm here for the adult role. Yeah, but you were a child actor. Yeah, but I'm not a kid anymore. I'm a really highly trained adult actor. Why don't you let me try out for this part? They're like, yeah, well, we'll pass, and we'll go with the other guy who's just caught off the bus from, you know, Indiana, and no offense to Indiana, yeah, and just got off the bus and in Hollywood, and we're going to go with that guy rather than you because he wasn't a child actor. That's the thing that happens. It's pretty clear, and of course, it wasn't clear at the time. I was like, hey, what's wrong with me? Do I smell like Limburger cheese? What's the problem? Yeah. And this is a very common situation with most child actors when they reach a certain age. It happens at different stages for different people, women and men, different times. But you basically, you're done, or the business is, no, you're not done. The business is done with you. And this is a very hard moment when child actors reach that point. to cope with what's going on. First of all, to figure out what's going on, to realize that it's not any fault of theirs. But what happens is your self-esteem takes a huge hit, and your identity is thrown into a tailspin because, like, whoa, wait a minute. I was really good. I was getting all this work and attention and validation. All of a sudden, boom, it's over. And what's going on? Hey, man, I just gave up my childhood so I could have this career, and now it's done. Wait a minute. No. And so this is what happens to a lot of child actors. So like you were saying, you know, the kids from different strokes, you know, the people, very different, you know, even Johnny Whitaker, you know, he's not really doing much work as an adult. He's got another profession going on, to his credit. And just as I had to do back in my mid to late 20s, I left the business. Well, the business left me, I should say. And I decided, well, I got to figure out something else to do, you know, positive with my life, gainful employment, etc. And I wanted to be my own boss. So I started my own business doing designing home theaters and sound systems. And we were talking about degrees of separation. I ended up working for people like Johnny Depp. I did 3 homes for Johnny Depp. I did 2 homes for Nicolas Cage. I did a beautiful surround system for Robert Downey Jr., Charlize Theron, wow. Sharon Stone, Ben Stiller, Chuck Norris, Dwight Yoakam. The list goes on. So, and these are people who I had, you know, personal relations with as a professional in my own field, as an expert in my own field, and also as a somewhat contemporary of theirs, meaning that they knew, I let them know that I was an actor and that I had some, you know, had some good credits and stuff. And they're like, oh, okay, he's one of us. He's cool. We can trust him that he's not going to breach our privacy. Because, you know, this is what I learned in my own, when I did my own business, is that folks at that level of stardom, privacy is the most precious commodity in their life. Yeah. At that point, it's very expensive to acquire privacy when you're that famous. And so that's a life that I feel like I dodged a bullet, that I didn't have to live that, even though I wanted to aspire to that. In a way, I lived a much more relaxing, fulfilling and safer life than what so many people who do achieve that level of stardom have to cope with. It's really difficult. I mean, honestly, you get paid a lot of money, but you have to spend a lot of money just to have some me time and not have paparazzi chasing you around everywhere, you know. So it's interesting. So just talking about degrees of separation, I'm kind of riffing around in circles here, but
I think you made a very, well, a lot of points there, but a great point there. Rodimus Pará is our very special guest, and again, young grasshopper, young Kane on Kung Fu is a role and a recognition that he'll never outlive or outgrow, and why would he want to? He was so wonderful in that. But Night Gallery and Marcus Welby and so many other, Little House on the Prairie, a big arc there, and terrific. Red Dawn, so many great roles, and a former child star, and again, we talked a little bit about Kung Fu, the film coming out, and we touched on that, and we'll touch on that again. But Rodimus Pará here with me, Frank McKay. We got a couple moments more with Rodimus. Let me just touch on something you just said there about the privacy, and I think it was a great point. And you were one of them. You are one of them, and they see you as, you know, you get it. You understand. It made me think of I don't know if you were a Sopranos fan, but there was a Sopranos episode where Christopher, you know, Christopher Moltisanti, played by Michael Imperioli, who we've had on the show, he's going through drug battles, and he's, you know, serious drug problems, and they wanted to have an intervention, you know, and figured to save him. And, you know, here they are, they're in the mob, you know, and where do you go for an intervention? And they went to another guy who had that kind of past. He was an insider. He was like one of them, and he wasn't exactly one of them, but he was close enough to be one of them where they trusted him, and he's the guy who held the intervention. And it's a great episode. I don't remember the name of the episode, but it was a great episode. And they had to get somebody from, you know, for example, in the life of crime, or who had a past in crime, and to do this intervention in order to trust him. And it's a good point, what you made. And again, maybe it's apples and bowling balls, but I don't think so. I mean, you're bringing up a good point. Folks that are in the business, folks that are from the world of acting and entertainment, and have that kind of celebrity, and you've been around huge celebrities in your life. I mean, Bill Cosby, David Carradine, and everybody, Michael Landon, everybody that we've mentioned, and you know it and you get it. And the fact that you brought that up, I think is interesting. And it's something that the rest of us, people on the outside of the acting world, just wouldn't know. I think it's a very good point you made.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, I don't know where to go with that, but sure. Okay,
well,
thank you.
Well, listen, the bottom line is once you're there, you're there. I mean, did you ever feel that you were completely removed from the business? I know you feel you were shut out from the business. But
I see. Well, yeah, I don't mean to overemphasize that point.
No.
Tell you the opposite. Yeah, I'll tell you the opposite end of it. When did I know that I was a star? When did I know that I had made it?
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, the Kung Fu being the number one hit show, that didn't quite make me feel like it because I was going back to regular public school with a shaved head and being, you know, ostracized by my peers. I certainly didn't feel famous or loved or adored. But at that same time, when I saw issue number 164 in November of 1974 of Mad Magazine, and there I was.
Ah, I remember that. Oh, my gosh.
Caricatured in Mad Magazine. That's when I knew that I maybe was famous. And I was like, whoa, I'm in Mad Magazine. This is the coolest thing. You know,
wow.
So that was,
yeah.
That was the big moment for me.
Well, listen, stay right there, though. You touched on something, and I was going to ask you that you had to shave your head in order,
yeah,
you know, to do the role. And here you,
yep,
are going into a, a school system that wasn't up on the bullying problem that, you know, that we are today. You know, we're
right.
We're completely aware of what's going on there. What was it like going back for you? Were you being bullied? Were you being teased, or were there groups of kids that were admiring you because they loved the show?
Well, if there was any admiration going on, it was at a distance. I certainly wasn't aware of it. I was on the opposite end of the treatment spectrum there. I got bullied. I got teased. This was 1973. You can imagine in 1972, I was in sixth grade, and in 73, 74, I was in eighth grade. And both of those years, I had my head shaved. In between, I wore a makeup prosthetic. But even with wearing the skull cap makeup, you still had to keep your hair fairly short. Every other boy in school at that time had hair down to his shoulders because it was, you know, skateboarding and BMXing and, you know, it was the 70s. So boys with short hair were real oddballs. And ones with bald heads, this is before punk, right? So we're talking like you had to either have had cancer or a really bad case of head lice to have a shaved head, you know.
Yeah.
And the third category was a star of a hit TV show. But, you know, that was a very rare category. So, yeah, I got a lot of... I didn't have a lot of self-confidence, oddly. My mom, you know, was a single mom, and I didn't have a dad around, so I didn't have anybody to really take me aside and go, hey, don't listen to those people. They're just jealous, you know, and you be proud of yourself and go out there and don't let them, you know, don't let them eat your lunch. Well, I didn't have anybody to tell me that, so, yeah, I would go to school feeling kind of dejected, and then, you know, the gang kids would come by, the gang members, wannabes, and they'd be, you know, push my books out of my hands and, ski ball, eight ball, you know, and it was not a picnic, let me tell you.
Terrible.
But,
wow, that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were no other kids, and again, Rodimus Parah here with me, Frank McKay, a former child star and just a wonderful career he's put together. There was no other child star in that school, and if the answer is no, do you think it was a mistake not to kind of try to get you into a school where you would have been surrounded by the Brady kids or
right,
you know, people,
yeah,
like that?
Right. Well, you know, how do I say this? My mom was not as resourceful as she might have otherwise been. There was a moment I do remember. Bringing me to something called the Hollywood Professional School, where there were some other child actors attending. And for some reason, both her and I kind of just like went, this is not a cool place. There's something very odd about this place. We both got that feeling. You know, and actually, in retrospect, even though I had a really tough time, I am proud of the fact, if I can say that much, I'm glad that I went to public school because I had exposure to real life. I had to take the bus, the public transportation, you know, to and from junior high. I had to also ask my teachers to let me leave early for my last class because I also had bullies who were telling, you know, who were warned me at lunchtime, I'm going to see you after school and I'm going to kill you. You know, I had that going on at the same time when I was on Kung Fu, because, you know, nothing would be a better feather in their wannabe gang existence if they could kick Kung Fu's ass.
Yeah.
So I actually had to run away from school and catch the earlier, you know, public transportation bus back home so I wouldn't be killed, you know, or that's what I thought anyway. This is the fear that I had in me. And of course I had to protect my face because I had to show up on the set the next day without a broken tooth or a bloody nose. So, you know, so there was that going on too. Yeah, it was complex. It was stressful. I wasn't having a great time at that time, but even still, I am grateful for the fact that I had that as a reference point for normalcy in my life, being in a regular public school rather than some sort of rarefied special school for actor kids. I just don't think that would have been as good for me as in the long run as it was. Even though I was abused and tortured, which wouldn't have happened as much, perhaps maybe the torture would have been more psychological. The competition with other child actors might have been even more bizarre than just being challenged to a fight, you know?
Wow. So. Just wow. I have a newfound understanding too. You know, yeah, I didn't even think of that Kung Fu and what a feather in their cap, like you said, it would be to beat up a kid from Kung Fu, you know, young grasshopper,
right.
You know, and what a star on their chest. So, you know, so they thought, terrible. But listen, you got through it and you sound like a terrific guy. First time we're talking, and I'd love to have you for a part two and a part three. There's so much to talk about here. And I think important things that you said, and you got me thinking about a whole batch of things. We got about 2 minutes left, and again, not to get nosy here, but when I talk to the Brady kids, for example, they complain about getting ripped off with residuals and not having anything when they get older. When I talk to the my three sons brothers, you know, the Livingston brothers, they did very well, and you know, their mom was in the business and she understood. So they're, you know, and by the way, they were a little earlier than the Brady Bunch. What was your experience without being too specific, if you don't want to be, are you happy with the amount of money that you ended up with at the end of your acting career, or are you unhappy?
Oh, okay. Well, since we only have about a minute left, let me just say this. My mother did not manage my funds well. She did not put aside any money for me for my college or anything like that. I left home at 17 years old with $1,200 and a beat up old Volvo, and that's how I started my life.
Wow.
And it put a strain on my relationship with my mom. I ended up finally, after I got married in my early 20s, I ended up facing a lawsuit against her to try to settle the score with her, because it was really unfair. She was doing other things, taking money from other members of my family too. And I wanted to put a stop to that. So I actually took her to court. It never went to court because at that time things were bogged up for about 4 years, but we settled out of court for a paltry sum. And she stipulated that she didn't want to talk to me again. So we actually had a 10-year gap of not talking to each other, which then I actively, proactively put an end to and created a dialogue with her. And, you know, by the time she passed away a few years ago, we were good. We were good. I took care of her. I moved her out of a house that she had lived in for 43 years, which was a nightmare process in itself. And I love my mom, and we made peace. So that's good. So I just want to put a good end on that story. But there were a number of years there where, it was not so great. And yes, my residuals were before the big actor's strike, and therefore they were pretty little. So in terms of money goes, I did not make money from my career, no. But I'm not an unhappy person, so there you go.
I can tell. And listen, everything I've ever heard about you, I said this to you in email, has just been, you know, glowing review of what type of guy you are and what kind of person you are.
Aww.
And everything that I've heard here just echoes that and underlines that. But I want to thank you very much for being here. Congratulations. You landed on your feet, and it's a lot better than a lot of child stars can say. But what a career you've had. And and hopefully, a resurgence coming with some.
I have to tell you, I did a couple of somersaults and twists before I landed on my feet. Just so you know.
we need a part two for sure. But listen, congratulations on being where you are, and mentally, emotionally,
oh, thanks.
and for making amends with your, not amends, but, you know, forgiving your mom, basically. And Rodimus Pariah, a terrific guy. Thrilled for having you here. Do you have a website, a social media site where you could point people to?
There's Rodimus Pariah on Facebook, which is a page for me, and people can come visit there. And I try to post. It's fairly new. I try to post, you know, pictures for my career, and I answer questions. If people have questions for me, I will, do a fairly good job of getting back to them about stuff like that. So, so that's one place. I'm also writing my memoirs. I've got some interesting stories, which we've only touched a small fraction of course, in this limited time that we had. By the way, you've just been made this so easy for me, Frank. You really wonderful interviewer, so I'm honored to obviously you've been doing radio for a long time because you're such a pro, I can tell, and you made it really easy for me, so thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, listen, thank you. The honor is mine. Rodimus Pariah, thank you once again, and to everyone out there, Frank McKay signing off. Rodimus Pariah has been our very special guest. Again, a young grasshopper, young Kane from the Kung Fu series, and so many others. Night Gallery, I thought is just a wonderful performance in the Night Gallery episode. Red Dawn, another cult favorite and a big-time movie. Little House on the Prairie, he had a wonderful string of shows there with Mr. Edwards' adopted son, oldest adopted son, John Jr. And again, what a career he put together, and really an underappreciated talent. The talent is Rodimus Pariah. Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.